You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Mike Osborne. Daniel Ellsberg is perhaps best known for his role in publishing the Pentagon Papers. But few people know that prior to the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg had deep experience with U.S. nuclear weapons policy. In the 1950s and 60s, he worked as a high-level defense analyst, and he participated in developing U.S. nuclear war plans during the Kennedy administration. Last year, Ellsberg published a memoir called The Doomsday Machine. And in his book, he argues that during the height of the Cold War, the U.S. developed a series of immoral and dangerous policies regarding the use of nuclear weapons. He says that surprisingly little has changed in the years since, and that the legacy of the arms buildup during the Cold War and its proposed renewal under the Trump administration continues to threaten our very survival. Ellsberg recently visited FSI's Center for International Security and Cooperation, where he participated in a Q&A about his book, The Doomsday Machine.
Thank you for the introduction, Scott, and you've done some of my introductions, which Dan will be very relieved at because he does not want to talk about the Pentagon Papers. He doesn't want us to talk about the Ellsberg Paradox. He doesn't want us to talk about his career at Harvard. So I'm going to just mention a couple of your books, not the Pentagon Papers, which, of course, I don't have right here, but... Years and years ago, Dan wrote a book called Secrets. He wrote a book on the what was it called? Papers on the War. I think 1972. I remember reading it, and Dan argued that the U.S. was not in a quagmire. This in Vietnam. It isn't that the U.S. had just kind of stepped in and couldn't figure out how to get out. He said it was really about domestic politics and that no president wanted to lose the war during his watch. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't be that cynical. But years have passed, and I now, I long ago became completely convinced of that. Then he wrote a book called Secrets, which is really magnificent. For undergraduate or graduate teaching, or if you want to know how the government works, there's just nothing as detailed and vibrant about how it really works, about how your boss might put a hair on his files to know if you went into them. It's a really gripping read, and it's just terrific. And now we have the Doomsday Machine, which is all that you want to talk about, which is fine since many of us here are really pretty interested in nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons policy. So let me ask you a few questions, and then we'll open it up. And as we discussed, if you want to deviate from the few questions I have here, just let me know. We can work it out together. Why don't you first tell us a little something about how it is that the world knew about the Pentagon Papers in 1971, but not some other documents that you had? Do you want to tell us a little bit about just what you were copying?
Well, from really days or weeks after I started copying the Pentagon Papers, top secret history of the war, 47 volumes, 7,000 pages, at a time when I believed that the war was... I knew from inside work, Morton Halpern, John Paul Vann, and others, that Nixon did not intend to get out of the war with a loss for the United States, that what he meant by honor was to continue our ally or puppet General Q in power through his second term. In other words, what some people thought he had in mind as a decent interval was not 6 months or a year and a half or 2 years. It was really 8 years. And then he would leave office with General Q in Saigon in power. And hopefully, and he actually achieved this without U.S. ground troops anymore, but with U.S. air power. And actually, he did achieve that. When he left office, General Q was in power. And I think the war would not have ended without Nixon out of office. But I didn't have that aim in mind, actually, when I put out the Pentagon Papers or when I copied them. However, at the same time that I was copying those, I was also copying all the contents of my top secret safe at RAND. I was one of the few people at RAND who did have a top secret safe in my office, didn't have to go to the top secret control office to read stuff. And that reflected in part the fact that I had the bootleg copy of the Pentagon Papers, which was not entered into our top secret files by the order of the people who gave it to us, actually. Paul Warnke, Mort Halpern, Les Gelb, did not want it entered into the files because they were afraid that if LBJ or his out of office or Walt Rostow learned that there was such a study of our decision making, they would track it down and destroy it. So there was an agreement that this would not be entered into files and show up in the records. But I was the single person at RAND authorized to be reading it. I had worked on the study and had been given permission to read the whole 47 volumes for comparative patterns of decision making in Vietnam.
Jim, why don't you say something about who started this secret study?
Well, that's the old story. McNamara had decided to do a case study of what a failure in Vietnam, essentially. He didn't use that word, but that was uppermost in his mind. How had we gotten into this, and what could be learned from it for future people who had access to top secret documents? It came from, I think, his own work in the Harvard Business School on case studies as a way of learning entrepreneurship and learning executive decision-making and so forth. The point was, though, that I decided that what needed more urgently to get, or rather, more importantly, rather, to get out was the information that I'd gathered over years working on nuclear command and control for CINC-PAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, study done by Office of Naval Research in the late 50s, and later in the Pentagon on nuclear war planning. And that work on command and control and the either authorized or unauthorized use of nuclear weapons by people who were in the had access to nuclear weapons led to my being asked to do the revisions, do a revised version of what was called the Basic National Security Policy, which was the guidance for the annual operational war plans from the president. Now, in the end, Kennedy decided not to issue a BNSP, a Basic National Security. He didn't want to commit himself to a particular strategy, which could be leaked or whatever, but it was what I drafted in that form as guidance for the war plans was adopted by Secretary of Defense McNamara and sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1961 as Secretary of Defense guidance for what was then called the Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, Annex C. It was the war plan, for the war plan. And it was a very strong revision of the Eisenhower plan, which we had inherited. And that's what I wanted to get to, what concerned me about this. I knew probably as well, as much about that planning as any civilian at that time, young as I was. The route I'd gotten into it on the command and control work and then on nuclear war planning. And I'd read the earlier war plans, especially in the Pacific, but also the Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, which was the JSCAP, which was very little known and was meant to be very little known by civilians in the Pentagon. And I briefed McGeorge Bundy, the assistant to national security to President Kennedy, in his first month, actually, on what needed changing or what the properties were of the Eisenhower plan, which was a very, very strange plan in some ways in the history of war planning. For example, it had allowed no existence of reserves of any kind for strategic forces in the event of war with the Soviet Union. And I should also mention that war with the Soviet Union, meaning anything above a skirmish, say in the Berlin corridor, of a company or two companies, anything up to, say, a brigade, was regarded as, defined as, general war. That was armed conflict with Soviet forces. And there was one plan, essentially, for dealing with that. As I say, it allowed for no decision-making by the president during the war or after the first decision to go to war was involved. It really involved trucking thermonuclear weapons by that time, by the late 50s, as many as we had and as fast as we could by all available planes as they came available out of training or maintenance or whatever, including the alert forces, over to hit every city in Russia and the USSR and China. Although the major number of targets were listed as military targets, bases, air defenses, command and control, most of these or many of these were in cities. And in any case, the cities themselves were all targeted. That only accounted for some hundreds of weapons out of thousands that were to go. But the plan also called for hitting every city in China. Now, as I've said, general war is defined by armed conflict with the Soviet Union, in which case we would execute Annex C, or what came to be known in 61 as the PSYOP, the Single Integrated Operational Plan, PSYOP 62, with the 62 referring to the end of the fiscal year, which would be in end of June 1962. This was now 61. Why China? Well, Sino-Soviet bloc, in theory, although that had been questionable from the late 50s, and especially by 60 or 61, that whether there was a Sino-Soviet bloc, actually. But the idea was, in particular in the Pacific, if you're going to be at war with Russia, you don't want China to be at the side inheriting the earth, basically, as China, as US and Russia destroyed each other. China was to be hit too, as well. That seemed to me a very, very strange, condemnable, let me say, idea. General Shoup, the commandant of the Marine Corps, when he was briefed on this plan, as I describe in the book, raised the question. He said, at SAC headquarters, he said, killing X number, and I'll get to that, of Chinese when it's not even their fight is not a good plan, as the PSYOP had been described up till that point. That it's not a good plan. That is not the American way. But it was the American plan. And one thing that I thought that Bundy, just one of a number of things that Bundy needed to be told about at that point, was this determination to hit China, no matter how the war had started, over West Berlin, over conceivably Yugoslavia at that time, or Iran, or over an uprising in the East, Europe that had escalated and somehow NATO had gotten involved. The Joint Chiefs thought of that, by the way, as a very considerable possibility, more likely than a surprise attack by the Soviets, which was the latter was the total focus of the RAND Corporation that I'd come from, deterring or responding to being able to respond to a Soviet surprise attack. The late 50s were the years of the missile gap, supposedly, when the Russians, who were the first to have launched an ICBM shortly before they launched Sputnik, which demonstrated to the world that they had this capability, were thought to have many, many more ICBMs than the US had or would have, that the gap was even going to increase in the future. And by 61, when I was writing, there was some question was being raised in early 61 as to whether the gap was as large as people thought. But the Air Force continued, and CIA actually continued to say that they probably had something like 160, some say 120, 160 ICBMs at a time when we had 40, but they were predicted to be going into hundreds within a year or two. I was at SAC headquarters in August of 1961, talking to the chief of war plans, Dave Lieben, that I'd known in the Pentagon, actually about their response to the new revised plans that I had drafted and had just been sent down to them. And in the course of that, Lieben mentioned to me, you know what the old man here thinks, Tommy Power, the commander of SAC, believes they have? No, tell me, he said, 1,000. This is a time when we had 40 Atlas and Titan ICBM, and plus about 120 Polaris missiles at sea, plus Thor and Jupiter in Italy and Turkey, and several thousand planes within range of Russia, okay, at that time. But the idea still was they have 1,000 ICBMs. A month later, the Discover Corona satellites had confirmed, had finally had adequate coverage of the possible launch sites in Russia and had concluded that what the Russians had at that time was four ICBMs at one site on Plesetsk, four slow liquid-fueled missiles, very vulnerable to a single plane, basically, close to nothing, which meant, by the way, that they had not tried to have an superiority in numbers of missiles to us. They could have done so with their big, clumsy SS-6, but chose not to do so. And that was about the only time they could have had a real first strike capability against our forces in the U.S. Nevertheless, they did have several hundred missiles, medium range and intermediate range, focused on Germany in particular, but on Europe, on all our bases in Europe. A lot of those were mobile. We didn't know the locations of a number of others. There was essentially no way for us to eliminate Russian ability to annihilate Europe by a U.S. first strike. So they had Europe as hostage, and Khrushchev had thought earlier that was enough to neutralize our force. They were holding our allies hostage. Actually, in the estimates of that time, you find very little consideration even of what would happen to Europe. The estimate just was what will happen in U.S. and USSR and so forth. I say I wanted to release information eventually. We're now talking, I've jumped ahead here to 69, which is what Lynn asked me about. In 69, I thought at last I will release a lot of the information that I had presented to Bundy much earlier, in which I notes of mine, estimates, programs of various kinds. And here were some of the things that I told him about and which I thought the public ought to know by that time. First, that our forces had always been essentially first strike forces. After all, in the late 40s, we had a monopoly of nuclear weapons and expected it falsely to go on indefinitely. That was a delusion by Truman and Groves, which I think almost any scientist could have disillusioned them of if it hadn't been so secret and they had discussed it at all. But they thought they would have a monopoly for a considerable time, for 4 years, of course, only. And in that light, our forces were built up in NATO and so forth to destroy Russian cities in the event of war with a monopoly. That ended, as I say, in 49. But after the Russians got forces, immediately SAC then acquired hundreds and hundreds of new targets in the USSR. Every airfield became a necessary target from which they might launch something against the US. And eventually, when they did finally get missiles, of course, all of those became targets for multiple hits. And above all, Moscow. I might mention, by the way, that I could never quite understand, then till now, the emphasis in the Strategic Air Command on hitting Moscow as their number one target. Starting out with the notion that the Russians had a lot of missiles that we couldn't find and that we could not destroy, to leave them without command didn't seem to me a, shall I say, prudent or let me just say, sane thing to do. To create a situation in which dozens, maybe hundreds, at sea and missiles elsewhere were on their own, essentially, to destroy things. How did you ever get the war ended? How could you talk of bargaining or prevailing or achieving tolerable terms when there was no one to bargain with on their side or probably on our side with Washington gone? That has never made any sense to me, and to my knowledge, that has remained the main objective, decapitation, in a general war from then till now. We could go into what the psychological or whatever reasons there might be for that. It is, of course, the one way conceivably you could paralyze the other side and come out of a general war alive, survive it. It's the one way, really, that they ever thought could do that, and so that made it attractive. Except that it gave up any notion of what I, with my colleagues at RAND, had thought to try to install instead, which was a kind of control in general war. Obviously impossible if you're decapitating the other side and if they're doing that to you. But so I would say that what I was doing, along with what Bernard Brody or Herman Kahn or Albert Wolfson thought of doing, Bill Kaufman, at that time was essentially infeasible if, in fact, there was to be no command system on the other side to prevail with. But the other things that I said was the emphasis was always on first strike, not out of the blue, not a preventive war ever. That was considered by Eisenhower but rejected in 1953, never really picked up by anyone. There were people, but really very few, like Curtis LeMay, I think, who did take that possibility seriously, but not otherwise. But a preemptive war, as some people took it, going second first, on warning that the other side was attacking, was the basis for our planning and the kinds of weapons that we built. Likewise, the possible escalation of a limited conflict in Europe or elsewhere to a U.S. first strike, as I say, not out of the blue, but as an escalation, hitting their military targets and, incidentally, the cities that they were near. Oh, okay. So, whereas at RAND, the focus was entirely on how do we prevent a Soviet first strike, which, as I've just said, was a something we believe was a real worry, but was a delusion, basically. It was not a problem. It was a false problem, which the Army and Navy somehow managed to perceive, but the Air Force, our sponsors, did not perceive until late in the game. But there were problems, and that was to keep the Russians out of West Europe or elsewhere, by threatening that we would strike them first and limit our damage. So damage limiting was the main objective. And I know we'll talk with Lynn. I know she's talked to SAC commanders like Russ Doherty, who I knew as a colonel in the Pentagon in 60-61. Okay, second, that it was not possible for the Soviets to decapitate the US and paralyze our forces by an attack on Washington or other command posts, because the president had very secretly delegated authority in such a case if Washington were hit or if communications were otherwise cut off with Washington to launch weapons if they thought it appropriate. He had delegated this in writing to field commanders. That was a super secret, and the fact that it was secret is something worthy of some questioning, because how do you deter the Russians from seeking to decapitate us if they don't know that the authority has been delegated? But it was afraid that the president was afraid, I think with reason, that that would scare the American people too much, and we did not tell the Russians that. Our own plans for decapitating the Russians, which got increasingly public later in the 70s, under actually Carter and Ford and Reagan, did stir the Russians, of course, into their dead hand system, their perimeter system, so that we couldn't paralyze them. In other words, essentially, not going into the details here, pretty much what we'd done, so that, this decapitation idea would not have worked on the Russian to paralyze them. The danger, though, involved in that and the possibility of false alarms seemed clear enough. And as I say in the book, and a lot of you have studied these false alarms, Bruce Blair, who was here for a long time, was he not? Or not? No? Okay, but anyway, I heard him here once, I guess. David Hoffman gave a talk, I heard, on the dead hand in Russia. So we had this delegation, first strike, hitting cities in China, and a number of other problems that I saw. Let me jump ahead because we're getting late here. I'll just say that as of 69, none of this had come out, and I thought that it was time that it did. So having started long ago to answer Lynn's question, I will now say it. I did copy those documents. I didn't have the actual war plans, but I had many verbatim transcripts, paragraphs that I had copied from my own research and work that I was doing, and my own work and so forth, as much as the Pentagon Papers, actually thousands of pages, perhaps as much as 7,000 or 8,000 pages. It so happens, to make it brief, and I tell the story here, I decided that I would put those out after the Pentagon Papers had had a run, had had their effect, whatever they would, on the Vietnam War. As a friend of mine who was going to prison in draft resistance, told me just before he went to prison. I told him what I'd done, and he said, Dan, don't put out the what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers, the Vietnam Papers. We know enough about Vietnam. That's all out there. The nuclear is much more important. And I said, yes, it is more important. But Vietnam is where the bombs are falling right now. And I want to do what I can. If I put out the nuclear, people will pay no attention to the Vietnam part, and war will not be affected. So I'll do what I can on the with the Pentagon Papers and put out the nuclear ones afterwards. I had no doubt that the nuclear papers would certainly put me in prison for life. And the Pentagon Papers probably would do that. So I was going either way. I gave the nuclear papers to my brother for safekeeping in New York. He moved them several times for protection, and they ended up in a box, in a box inside a green garbage bag in the town dump at Tarrytown, New York, underneath to market a large green iron stove that would show where they were, and that was above a bluff in which he buried the papers on the side of a road. During my first trial in 71, my brother informed me that a hurricane, Tropical Storm Doria, had hit that area in New York and had moved the stove about 100 yards, and the bluff had turned down over the cliff with its contents. Couldn't find it. And even so, for the next year and a half, I really hoped that he would find them, because he spent every weekend with a friend searching that dump, trying to see if they could turn up something. And I somehow assumed surely they will get it eventually. At one point, they hired a backhoe to turn dirt over and found a lot of garbage bags, 1,000 garbage bags, but none with top secret documents inside. And eventually, the fill from that dump was used as fill for a condominium nearby, and they poured concrete over it. So I had to give up on that. And people have asked me why I haven't put out this information, which is in this book. This book basically gives the contents of the other Pentagon Papers that I'd copied, as well as I can remember, which is pretty well, because I told my lawyer at the time what I had done, one lawyer only, and had long transcripts from that period as early as 71, which I tried to publish in 75, as soon as the war had ended. I gave a lot of those transcripts, and my editor at that time at a larger publisher said, well, we'll sell 1,400 copies of this, you know, History of Nuclear Weapons. And I said, all right, you know, that's one for every member of Congress, good, hard copy, and some journalists and some academics, that's fine. She said, no, that means we won't publish it. And in fact, that's been true ever since. I've been lecturing on the subject, I've testified about it in trials, to no, under oath, to no attention to anybody covering the trial. And in fact, this book was turned down by 17 publishers before Bloomsbury took it up. It's a, nobody wants to read about nuclear war. Now, okay, that's long answer to your question.
That's a very full response to my question. And of course, that means we're going to have to change tack a little bit. So I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we'll open it up.
Okay.
You can be somewhat fulsome in this answer if you'd like to be. Not as fulsome as you were, but when it comes to the audience, you know, we'd like to have at least 20 questions, 15, 20.
Okay. Yeah.
So that will be Scott's pleasure to try to make you a little more succinct. And this is, of course, fascinating. So that has, the length has nothing to do with how incredibly interesting this is. So, Dan, one of the things that struck me, and you didn't tell this story here, and it's just great in the book, and don't tell it here, is that when you got the number back from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this was a set of questions you had written them, one of the questions went out over the president's signature, and you were shown the answer.
Yeah.
We know that other civilians have also had overwhelming moral reactions. But I haven't.
You do? Who would you name? Who comes to
well,
your mind?
Well, I would like you to
from
name,
the Pentagon.
If you'd like to. Okay. If no, not. The real question is, what shall I say? What's wrong with you? The question is, why did you have this reaction and very few others and no one in your position had the kind of reaction that you've had? I mean, this is, in a sense, your life's work, making this known and understood. Why do you think it affected you in that way and not others?
I don't know.
That's succinct. That's succinct.
Okay. Well, with that great run, I think, Scott, I'll have you do the Q&A.
Great.
Could I comment on something you raised?
Of course.
The question of that has been in my mind is indeed, I've just turned lens around. How can it be that we, public at large, have been living with this situation and tolerated it for more than half a century? Partly, they don't know, of course, so they don't know. But how about the handful, the relatively handful of people who did know what we were talking about? Lynn has given away a punchline here, in effect, that I could have drawn, come up to a little more systematically. But the issue is that when asked who would be killed if we went first in an escalation in Europe or a Berlin crisis or whatever, the answer was 325 million people in the USSR and China, but also 100 million in East Europe, the captive nations, from strikes on their airfields and their air defenses and their command and control, and 100 million in West Europe from the radioactive fallout from our strikes in the East, without a single warhead landing on them, depending on which way the wind blew, which depended on the season to a large extent. But that meant that we contemplated killing collaterally and undesiredly 100 million of our NATO allies. Now, actually, that's just what happened from our strike. And it was an underestimate, as Lynn, more than anyone else, has shown, because they weren't figuring in fire, the main effect of thermonuclear weapons, heat. And that would have added several hundred million more to the casualties. So we're talking about 1 billion people from our strike out of a population of 3 billion. A third. Interestingly, by the way, I've heard Edward Teller say, and he said it more than once, the use of H-bombs, his baby, the thermonuclear weapons, the father of the H-bomb, could not kill more than a quarter, or one might have said a third, of the Earth's population. I heard him say that, sort of the glass two-thirds full, or whatnot. But, okay, the Russians then, in response, as I said, at that time, in early 61, might not have landed a single weapon on the U.S., there are 4 ICBMs. They might have had some submarines at sea with some capability. Might not. But they would have annihilated Europe, something that was not apparently a total deterrent to our carrying out our plans. So the question I've faced for 50 years is not actually, gee, why did this bother me? I mean, you know, the question I'm asking, that really didn't come into my mind. How can we have done this, and how could we this have persisted? It does persist, and a major thing in this book, I think, is to give attention, some would say more than it deserves, and I don't think so, to what was discovered 20 years later, which was that the major casualty-producing effect of this kind of attack would not be the blast or the prompt radiation or the immediate heat and the immediate fires. It would be something that they didn't consider at all as an effect of the attacks. The smoke from the cities that were hit, that were burning, and specifically not just smoke in the lower atmosphere, but smoke that would be lofted by the nuclear attacks into the stratosphere where it would not rain out and where it would cover the globe quickly, within days, and obstruct perhaps 70% of the sunlight, creating, and this was the first thing people focused on, ice age conditions on the Earth, frozen lakes, frozen rivers. But what is now emphasized much more in the last 10 years is killing all harvests for what turns out to be not 1 year, as they thought at first, this is all their computers could handle, but over a decade, meaning that nearly everyone would starve within a year or so from our attack or the Russian attack or both together. And that in India, Pakistan, thing much, much lower, incomparably lower in size, 100 fission weapons only, would reduce sunlight by 7% instead of 70%, shorten harvests, lower the food supply to a point where the 2 billion least nourished people on the planet would starve out of what is now 7.4 billion. So we had here, especially with the US and Russia, what could well be called, what Herman called, a doomsday machine. And as I say, even earlier, the notion that a billion people would be killed out of 3 billion would seem to be, you know, serious enough, let's just say. But we are talking about the Southern Hemisphere as well as the Northern Hemisphere, killing nearly everyone, not total extinction, because according to Alan Robuck and Brian Toon, probably some would survive, perhaps 1%, living on fish and mollusks in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia or New Zealand. But everybody else would starve. The last point I'd like to make here and on this is, there's a lot of talk here now about Trump's use, apparently conscious use, of what Nixon called a madman theory. The notion that he was unpredictable, impulsive, irrational perhaps, up to a point where he might actually carry out the threats that we were making, the fire and fury threats and the other threats. I want to say that, in fact, it was not only Nixon who was making such threats in 1969 when I was copying these papers. Every president has relied on a threat of initiating nuclear war against Russians in Europe that would essentially lead either, what they didn't know was to the death of everybody, but to the death of a third of the population. In other words, it has always been, our NATO policy has always been, I would say, the threat and the preparations and the capability and the readiness to take actions under some circumstances that are insane, criminally insane, murderous to a scale that human language doesn't comprehend. This could never happen before. It was not an issue for the human species until the last 70 years. But for 70 years, we've had a madman policy, and we still do. It didn't start with Trump. Our SAC forces constitute a doomsday machine on hair trigger alert, 10-minute alert, or less than that, as do the Russians. And the question is that in itself necessary, tolerable? I would say absolutely not, absolutely outrageous and intolerable. But it's being tolerated, and we're rebuilding on both sides those doomsday machines at the cost of hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars. So the question is, how can this be changed? It should be changed, I believe, very much so. But how, we have not discovered. No one in this room, no one in the country that I've seen has discovered how to change this policy. Most of them are not aware of it, but those that have, like myself, have certainly not succeeded in changing this course under either Democrats or Republicans. So if it needs changing, it's up to us, or people like us, I think, to try to think of how it might be done.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you liked this episode, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe and stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.